Live from the place where we're all about the fantasy football pool, it's the Stacking Benjamin Show. Hey everyone, I'm Joe's mom's neighbor Doug, and this is the last time I let Joe's mom pick my starting quarterback. I just lost all my Sizzler money to Len Penzo. So, just in the nick of time, here to help us all learn to be frugal, at least until the Detroit Lions defense shows up, help us welcome author Donna Friedman. Also today, Joe and OG will move the ball a few yards with their Target Date Fund headlines. They'll try a trick play by actually answering your questions, but we're going to spike the ball after my amazing game-winning football-related trivia question. And here they are, two guys who could use some time away from the concession stand, Joe and OG.
Another Monday on the show. Hey, everybody, I am Joe Saul-Sehy, Average Joe Money on Twitter, just so you know which voice is which. And across this rickety little card table in the basement is the one and only OG.
One of these days, we're going to upgrade this rickety card table. Is your coffee mug like a planter? Is that what that's supposed to
look
like?
It is. Yeah, it's from Garvin Gardens. Nice. One of my favorite places. It's in Hot Springs.
I'm rocking Mickey today.
When J.D. Roth was going across the United States, I said, I got to take you to this place. And he was kind of like, really? A gardens? We're gonna go to a gardens? I'm like, you're going to love it. He's like, yeah, okay. All right. And then we go to the gardens. And as we're walking out, he's saying, this is amazing. This was fantastic. It is. It's a great place. If you're ever in Hot Springs, Arkansas, Garvin Gardens. So,
got it. We'll
anyway, how's your weekend, man?
Another beautiful weekend. College football started.
How great is that?
Yeah, we're already week two into that.
That's amazing. Yeah, pro football. It's all crazy here. Yep. You know what else is crazy? People that don't want to go to stackybenjamins.com/magnify money. And I don't mean crazy in a good way. Remember the other day we were talking about people that are crazy in a good way? Like, that's a
good
thing?
You were talking about that.
I was. And you were questioning that logic. But this time, I'm not joking around. You're nuts. Like, not nuts in a good way if you don't go to stackybenjamins.com/magnify money. Because the average person saves 450 smackaroonies when they go there. You know, on Friday's show, when you weren't here, OG, I went to the debt refinance area with balance transfer cards. And it tells you right on the card, each individual balance transfer, how much money you will save switching to that card. And guess how much personal information you had to give them? Zero.
Nada.
StackingBenjamins.com/magnify money. We, of course, weren't surprised to find that our other sponsor, SoFi, was number one when it came to student loan refinances and for personal loans. And you know what's interesting about SoFi? Not only are they easy to work with, what Magnify Money says about them is that their fine print, very little. They get an A+ rating on the Magnify Money system for fine print. So get rid of the, you know, the little asterisks and the little tiny phrases that you need a magnifying glass to see. None of that with SoFi. Straightforward. You'll know very quickly whether they'll work with you and what the interest rate is. Student loan refinance, personal loans, you get $100 from them if you use our link. And you can also do mortgages through them. StackingBenjamins.com/SoFi. Great show today. We've got Donna Friedman from the frozen tundra. That's a football phrase right there.
It is.
Frozen tundra. But she really is. She's from Alaska.
Oh, yeah, that is yeah. A little more frozen than Green Bay.
Yeah. From Anchorage, Alaska. Donna Friedman's going
to
be.
You've been to Anchorage, haven't you?
Joining.
Yeah, yeah. You were just there a couple years ago.
Loved it. Her new book is called Your Playbook for Tough Times, Living Large on Small Change for the Short Term or the Long Haul. She's somebody who's gone through some seriously hard times, OG, with her money. She's got some great stories. If you know Donna Friedman, you know she's got amazing stories. Donna Friedman coming down to the basement. But first, we've got some more scary headlines, so let's move.
Hello, darlings. And now, it's time for your favorite part of the show, our Stacking Benjamin's Headlines.
Yeah, a little doom and gloom in today's headlines, OG. The first one comes to us from Napa-Net. Another lawsuit challenge. Lawsuit challenges target date fund selection and excessive fees. A plan sponsor...
Wait, so target date funds have excessive fees?
How about that?
Huh. That's odd. Say that again really loud. I didn't hear it the first time.
Lawsuit challenges target date fund selection, excessive fees.
Okay.
And everybody wonders why. And all we're going to get. Okay. You people are amazing. Our Stacking Benjamins audience is amazing. But you have to realize that you and Vanguard funds know each other very well. But the average person in the United States has no idea. And a lot of money goes into target date funds that are not the wonderful ones. So we get 50 bajillion letters about why we crusade against target date funds. And yep. William Byrd Thistle, we haven't played the Green Room episode yet where he rails on target date funds, but he says the same thing. You've got all of these horrible
fees. Anti-fund of funds, but there are some that are great. And target date funds are kind of fund of funds too.
So. Yeah. So please don't write me saying, but Vanguard, and I'll write you back and go, correct. You got it. Good job. Here's your gold star. Now let's talk about all the others. So this is by Nevin Adams. Nevin says a plan sponsor's record keeper facing a class action for its selection of what are alleged to be target date funds that charge excessive fees. The plan sponsor is Safeway, the grocery store chain, and its record keeper now in power by way of Great West, by way of JP Morgan Retirement Plan Services. Are being sued by way of.
Every time you say the word by way of, that's another layer of fees.
Absolutely. Are being sued by plan participant Dennis M. Lorenz for selecting target date funds, which are JP Morgan Smart Retire Passive Blend Funds affiliated with its record keeper.
A little home cooking.
Yes. Well, and not only were they picked by the record keeper. So record keeping is a difficult thing for 401ks. Let's talk about this. It's a difficult thing for 401ks. They got to keep track of a lot of stuff. There's a lot of rules to make sure that everybody's compliant. So there are charges for that. Yeah. However, what this plan did was it wasn't a set fee. It was a percentage of assets fee. And they're using funds affiliated with said record keeper.
Yeah, they're putting their own stuff in the sauce. So they're double dipping.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that what his lawsuit is?
That's what the lawsuit is that they're double dipping. They're not charging a set amount of money for how difficult this is. And it's a difficult job. They're charging a percentage of the assets. And those assets happen to be assets that are like.
And arguably, from JP Morgan's perspective, they're going to come back and say, well, we took a loss on all this up front
right.
to kind of get everything started in hopes of, you know, getting rewarded on the back end.
The suit notes that while the total participants in the plan dropped from a total of 41,363 participants with account balances in 2011 to 38,126 in 2014, the assets in those funds rose from $119 million to more than $244 million during that period, resulting in higher revenue sharing payments. In other words, the suit alleges JPMRPS/Great West received greater and greater revenue providing the same services, in fact, more than double the revenue in 2014 and 2011, for a smaller amount of record keeping that they were actually doing. These suits aren't going to go away, OG. I know we've talked about this,
they're
and
not.
I know that you hate them, but they're not going away.
Well, I don't hate this one. This one I'm okay with.
You hated the ambulance chaser.
Yeah, this one's definitely a case of double dipping. So I'm okay with this one.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how it turns out. Obviously, this is all alleged stuff. Let's move on to a second headline. This one you brought to me from the Wall Street Journal. This is something we've had a lot of people talking about side hustles.
Yeah, this is a side hustle deal.
Yeah. Right? So you get involved in Airbnb, put your room up on Airbnb, and then you go to refinance your house, OG. This is a story by Peter Ruttiger, says Airbnb income, how it can mess with your mortgage refi. This can be scary.
A lot of companies now are having trouble trying to justify exactly how to deal with this Airbnb quasi-rental situation, right? In the old world, or, you know, up until a year ago when Airbnb really took off, it was pretty easy. You either had a rental property or you had your primary residence, right?
One or the other.
Banks knew how to treat those, right? So they say, well, your primary residence has a lower propensity for default and a rental property would have a higher likelihood of default just because, you know, it's a rental property. You're viewing that as a different thing, right? So they charge higher interest rates and so on and so forth. But now companies, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, are telling people who rent their house on Airbnb, see ya. We're not dealing with that.
Yeah, because now your primary residence is a business.
Yes. So there's a story in here about a guy in Seattle, lives in Seattle, says he made $30,000 last year renting out his cottage in the back of his house.
Okay.
So not even his house, but like
on the same property.
Same property, like a little little doohickey there, maybe out back, $30,000. So he figured that that would, you know, that strengthens his income statement, right? He's, you know, I'm a better borrower now. Nope, got rejected from Bank of America because they said, yeah, now you have a commercial business on your property. We don't do that.
Yeah, it's funny because it makes his income stronger, but his income isn't stronger from outside that house. His income is stronger in the house.
Yeah, and that's their perspective is we're not going to count it.
Yeah, we're not going to count that income stream.
And we're going to classify you into a different risk category.
And that's not a little bit higher interest rate. That's a lot higher interest rate. I think the solution
Yeah, so just don't tell them, right? just take it off Airbnb right before you go to... What Airbnb listing, officer?
We didn't do it. Guys on Stacking Benjamin said we didn't have to claim that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we.
Well, there's all sorts of other stuff with there, right? There's the, you know, the income component of it and the taxation of it. You know, you get to rent your house out for a certain amount of days without paying income taxes, without claiming it, basically.
Right. But you go over that number.
But you go over it, and then now you're filling out all sorts of other forms.
It's a mess.
Liability insurance. Now you could probably have some commercial liability insurance, and you got to have. Some pretty healthy umbrella coverage, I would think. And does your primary home insurance count if you're renting your house for income?
And the separation of personal assets and business assets. Like if I have a bathroom that I use part of the time, but it's business part of the time, are those towels I bought for the business? And I know what the answer is. Yes. Yeah. They're for the yes, those are for the business.
Depends on who's doing your taxes is what the answer is.
Yeah. Depends on just what type of jail cell you want.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the small one or the extra small one.
So I think our lessons for today is number one. Wow. Target day funds might not be the magic solution that people say they are. Da-da-da. How about that? And then number two, we just love rubbing it in, don't we?
Airbnb is something that you got to, you know, it's not as easy as slapping it up and getting some money.
Yeah. There might have to be a little planning involved with your side hustle there too. Donna Friedman, come down to the basement, OG. This is going to be exciting. I absolutely love talking to Donna. She has phenomenal stories about difficult times. She has phenomenal stories about good times. Donna Friedman just has phenomenal stories. She not only was the person responsible for MSN's finance blog for a long time, Donna Friedman also has written many books and has been published all over. Her website, donnafriedman.com, has won awards, and it's called Surviving and Thriving. Life is short, but it's also wide. Is her subheader on that? Let's say hello to Donna Friedman coming down to the basement. And Donna Friedman joins us in the basement. Welcome.
Hey there, I'm noticing the musty smell is gone. Did you guys put that dehumidifier in finally?
Isn't that amazing what a new dehumidifier on their conditioning unit does?
It really does make a difference.
Well, thank you. It's so good to have you back. How have things been going in Alaska?
Sunny, scarily sunny. Thanks, El Nino.
Yeah, that's right. Well, at least it's not negative 50 degrees here in September.
No, it isn't. It's very sunny, and we're eating fresh tomatoes out of the greenhouse and kind of dreading winter.
Mom loves tomatoes. How come you didn't bring any of those with you?
Oh, shoot. Well, you know, we get greedy about our tomatoes.
That's right. When you get one, you gotta hunker down around it. Well, we're not here to talk about that, though. We're here to talk about your playbook for tough times. And Donna, you've had different periods of your life that were tough. And starting when you were young, you actually had to really, really struggle in the beginning.
Yeah, when I was 16, my parents split up, and my brother and I stayed with our dad in the family home. You have to remember, this was 1974 in a rural area. So as the only female in the household, it was my job to run the household. When my mother left, suddenly it was all on me to do everything. And my father and brother just sort of expected it, and I didn't know how to not do it, so I did it.
What did you learn from that experience?
Well, you know, I had already learned it by watching my mother and other women in our family survive on little money. So what I did was I did all the cooking from scratch, and I bought only sale-priced foods. We had a garden, so I canned and froze things. I hung out all our laundry instead of using the dryer. And I didn't ever ask for anything. I didn't say, oh, I don't have any gloves. I lost my mittens. Can I get a new pair? I just stuck my hands in my pockets. My brother and I were pretty low maintenance, luckily. But what I learned, I guess, was that you can get by on relatively little money and you don't have to be painful or disgusting. You know, we weren't surviving on ramen. Eating regular meals.
Does it feel like you were struggling, or do you feel like that time in your life made you stronger?
Well, it was a struggle at the time, but yes, it definitely taught me how to manage, because 4 years later, I was pregnant, so I had to take care of a baby and survive on a part-time salary. So yes, it made me much stronger.
So I was going to ask you about that. So here you are, you have a baby, and at one point, you're then a single mom. Tell me that story.
Well, when she was 10 months old, I moved back in with my mother because I was rather ill during the pregnancy. And I moved back in with her. But when the baby was 10 months old, I moved to Philadelphia. And I was living in just this crap hole of an apartment, although at the time I didn't realize that. And I was on what they call permanent part-time salary, which meant you might get 25 hours one week and 37 the next, but never full-time. So I had to pay for childcare, and I didn't have any child support or food stamps. So I did some pretty hardcore stuff. I washed all our laundry by hand and on a scrub board in the sink, even the cloth diapers. Lots of fun, good times. And I ate very, very simply. And she and I mostly lived on beans and spaghetti, things like that. A lot of beans, a lot of bean soup. I couldn't eat beans for years after I got married.
Well, you said too, at that point, you had no education.
No, I had 1 year of college. And that was it.
And you had no car?
No.
No. So how did you pull yourself out of that hole?
Well, I took public transit and I lived in that terrible apartment until it got shut down because it wasn't providing heat or hot water. And then I found another place and lived there. And a couple years later, I got married, as it turns out, to the wrong person because he was abusive. But everything was a learning experience. I'm in my 50s now. And when something bad goes wrong, I think, okay, what am I supposed to learn from this? Because there must be something, and I'd really like to learn it fast so the bad thing will go away. But seriously, I learned basically, and again, after 23 years with this marriage, a slow learner, I finally got the courage to leave, but then I went broke again. Because my daughter, who at this point is an adult, was disabled after an illness, and I was paying her bills while she waited for her disability. And then my ex made good on his promise to drag it out as long as possible so we'd both be broke when it ended.
Oh,
and,
no.
Yeah, I was pretty broke.
How did you get a full-ride scholarship to the University of Washington?
I applied for it, duh. No, I went back to a community college to start because it had been 30-some years since I'd been in college, nearly 30 years. Yeah. And I heard about this scholarship for people who were making the jump from community college system to the University of Washington. So I applied for it and I got it. Although I'll tell you, the first question they asked me at the interview was, do you think it's ethical of us to give this much money for education to someone whose working life is effectively at least half over?
Really? And you said, heck yeah.
My response in this tone was, yes.
Chuh.
Anyway, but yeah, through that too. I mean, I was working, I was managing an apartment building, I was going to school rather, and managing the apartment building, doing all these odds and ends. And then I got hired by MSN Money to write for them full time. So, you know, three times a week and going to school and managing the building. It got real lively there. But again, I learned that you could get by on relatively little money, which was good because now I had divorce-related debt.
Yeah, which is fun debt, right? Don't you list that in the book as good debt?
Yeah, I was going to say the only debt I ever had was for the divorce attorney, best money I ever spent. Right. And I believe in marriage, but just I didn't believe in that marriage.
Well, you start off with this idea of a financial fire drill. And when I first read about it, I'm like, what the heck, Donna, is a financial fire drill? And you do a great job of explaining it, but explain it to us. What is a financial fire drill?
Okay, well, like all fire drills, this is in case of emergency. How many houses or schools burn down each year? Relatively few, right?
Yeah.
But it's still a good idea to know what to do if it happens. So what you're doing is basically an extreme budget makeover. You write down on paper or on your computer or whatever the baseline budget, the absolute minimum you need to survive. That's basic shelter, food, clothing, utilities, debt service, and entertainment. So you pretend your house has lost some or all of its income. and you figure out what do I need just to pay the basic bills. And then you look at how much money will continue to come in, say unemployment or your partner's salary, and you figure out how much of a difference there is. And if the answer is a negative number, it's time to take another look at those wants versus needs.
But even some of the needs you have to look at that point, I would think.
Yes. For example, you would stop going out to eat.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people now, it's a culture. We go out to eat. We don't cook. You would either cook or learn to cook. But again, you'd look for inexpensive and healthy recipes versus, again, surviving on ramen and oatmeal for your whole life. That's not a healthy diet in the long term. And it's likely either to make you sick or to knock you off the wagon and back to charging up meals you can't afford. You would also maybe, say, take in a roommate or do something like that for your shelter. You would do something to bring in a little more money or to cut expenses somewhere. But this thing about the survival budget is it can be really liberating and reassuring you when you look at it and say, well, if push ever comes to shove, we could manage on $1,000 a month.
Right. No, that's a powerful thing to know.
It is.
Yeah. You say, though, when I was asking you about needs, I was thinking about, you talk about only, I love this line, only amateurs pay retail. And I thought, well, I must be an amateur. What do the pros do, Donna?
Well, in your playbook for tough times, there's a chapter called Your Frugal Arsenal, which I think of as weapons against waste. For example, using a cashback shopping, whenever you have to buy anything, use cashback shopping site like Mr. Rebates or Dollar Dig. You would get the lowest price available by using a price comparison website like Price Grabber or Nextag. And one of my favorite weapons against waste is to pay for everyday needs and also big purchases with a discounted gift card. For example, one of my wants is going to the movies with a friend. I probably go 3 or 4 times a month, but I get 20% off because I'm paying with a gift card that I paid 20% off for. When I go to Walgreens or the grocery store or to the home improvement center or take my nephews out for a burger, I'm doing it all at discounts of 15 to 30% or more. Now, for example, day-to-day purchases, you're going to buy cat litter anyway at PetSmart. Why not get PetSmart cards from these gift card places and pay 15% less? My frugal partner built a greenhouse for us, as I mentioned earlier, out of scrap lumber and old windows, but he wanted to buy this roofing material called SunTuff. So when we bought that material with discounted Home Depot gift cards, we saved a little over $97.
Wow.
On that. And we also printed out some coupons and saved us another $40. So we could have paid $137 more for that roof, but we chose not to. So think, and all the times you have to buy your kids' school shoes or pick up dog food or go to the drugstore, you're just building in an extra layer of savings to go with these sale prices and the store coupons that you're also using. So the best way to find these cards, by the way, it's an aggregator site called giftcardgranny.com. And that site lays out all the different resellers, and you can just go to the one with the best deal.
Awesome. I'll have a link to that, by the way, in the show notes also, everybody, at stackingbenjamins.com. That's good. Is that how you also get around clipping coupons? Because I can't stand clipping coupons. It just seems like every time we've tried to do that, it's been a big, fat waste of time.
It's not for everybody. In fact, my daughter, in her book, Frugality for Depressives,
right,
she did a whole part about coupons and how ultimately they ended up stressing her out and making her feel worse about herself. So she does is go to the store's website and find the coupons you want and download them to your loyalty card. And then when you swipe the card, when you pay the card, the coupons automatically come off. Yeah. I also recommend, though, if you go to a site like couponmom.com, they do the sale price and coupon matchup store for stores in all 50 states, drugstores, department stores like Target, grocery stores, and even dollar stores. And they have the downloadable coupons right there on the site, so you can just add them to your cards.
Makes it much, much easier. So now I'm not hanging out with the Sunday paper or printing stuff out. Yeah, what a mess.
And then you have to remember them. So a lot of people think, oh, the coupons are home. They're home on the kitchen table. Dang.
Right. I've been known to do that before, too.
I've never made a mistake. I wonder what it feels like.
I know. It's absolutely...
Excuse me. Sorry.
I do have a question about... Because when you're a very frugal person, I would think, you know, people talk about the debt spiral, Donna. Like getting into debt at all, when the budget is really tight, debt is like your biggest enemy because it's that much harder to climb out of it.
Mm-hmm. It is, because you feel worse and worse about it. Now, let's put it this way. People don't lie awake at night and think, oh, all my debts are paid. I have no credit card balance. I've got money in the bank. Woe is me.
Right.
they lie awake thinking, I had to go charge one more thing, and now my credit card balance is up by $60. That means more interest next month, and it's just going to get worse.
Well, and it doesn't even mean that. I mean, for somebody who's in a spot where you've been in the past, where they're really struggling, it also means I just put $60 on a card. I don't know where the hell that $60 is going to come from next month.
Exactly. And again, an emergency fund is really important. Liz Weston talks about having $500. If you have a $500 account, that will cover a lot of issues. There's a chapter in your playbook for tough times called Challenge Yourself to Save. And it talks about all these different sneaky ways, stealth savings tactics, I call them, that you can squirrel away a few dollars here and there. Having that money there is gold. Knowing that if you have to do it, it's there. You don't want to take it out, but that's why you have an emergency fund, because your kid grew out of his shoes.
Right.
You have to buy him new ones.
For some of those squirrel away money things, how much do you rely on apps now for that and technology?
I'm old school, so I don't use apps. Next question. I have heard people tell me that things like Mint.com and Power Wallet help them track their spending. I like a site called Digit because it takes a few dollars out of my account a few times a week. There's this algorithm that it figures out how much you can spend. Okay, Donna spends this much on electricity and this much on rent and this much on other stuff a month, and she gets paid twice a month. Okay, she can probably afford this much, and it sucks the money out and sends it to an online bank. And that's kind of cool. But for people who are living paycheck to paycheck, nothing like that is going to work.
Well, and I think it's liberating for people that they really don't need in all capital letters, the smartphone, you know, to make their budget work.
No, you really don't. I mean, a lot of people live on their phones. I've got this piece of junk flip phone that I bought almost 3 years ago. It works. I'm home all the time. I don't need a smartphone. I don't need to be contactable in that way or to be able to sign on to the internet from wherever I am, because I'm always here.
I love your phone, Donna, because when you first showed me your phone, I think about with my smartphone, how many times a day when, you know, I get this little buzz and I go, ah! And then I look at it and it turns, you know, it's something stupid. It's always something stupid.
Yep.
And I feel like I'm always on edge because of it. And then you showed me your phone and I just wanted to flip you off.
Yeah, well, it was a flip phone, so that seems appropriate.
You handle a bunch of stuff in the book, Entertainment on a Budget, Challenging Yourself to Save. You mentioned getting dressed on a dime. That was an interesting chapter. Living rent-free, and that's not just buying a tent, which is what I thought that was going to be. I thought it was going to be just a few words. Buy a tent, you're good. And you actually
yes.
had better
well,
stuff
it doesn't
than
work that way. No.
Probably not in Alaska, especially.
Really? But you can, well, there's a lot of, I mean, there's too many hacks to mention, but I do, for example, link to some government sites for things like Section 8 housing, but don't hold your breath. They have very long, long wait lists. But there are some stopgap measures you can do. There's shared housing and information on, for example, a directory of agencies that have shared housing. And sometimes you can work off some or most of your rent just by being a strong back. If you're moving in with some elderly people and what they want is somebody to shovel the snow and carry in groceries and maybe do a little housework, you might not have to pay rent at all.
The barter system.
Correct.
It's alive and well.
Win-win. Again, it's too much to do in a short podcast, but
right.
there's a lot of tactics out there you can use to stretch your housing dollars, shall we say.
Well, stretch every dollar in the book. Short-term help, staying healthy. Your playbook for tough times, living large on small change for the short term or the long haul. Where do people get it, Donna?
They can get it on Amazon or Kindle. And if you want it as a PDF for your laptop or your tablet and you don't have a Kindle, you can buy it off my website. And it's a dollar cheaper than the Kindle.
Oh, that's the
frugal hack. Also, if you want to buy the paperback, but have somebody you know could use the Kindle. If you buy the paperback, you can buy the Kindle for $1.99 because I opted in for that Kindle matchbook thing.
Oh, cool. Awesome.
So a frugal hack for a frugality book.
Awesome. Well, that's a perfect match. And we'll have links to those in the show notes as well. Well, good luck with the rest of the book launch, the book tour. This is a fun time.
Yeah, it will be. I can't wait to see everybody at FinCon so I can say, have you read my book yet? Why not?
That's right. You have to. Amen. And speaking of that, we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
All right. Talk to you then.
Hey everyone, it's Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug. Well, it's that holy time of year again where everyone gathers along a big field with white painted lines on it for that ritual known as football. In honor of that, here's today's trivia question. Which NFL team has the least expensive tickets? I'll have the answer right after I replay that horrible last-second field goal attempt Thursday night when the Panthers cost me $50. Not that I was gambling on a football game, kids. That would be illegal.
I'm so excited to have two sponsors that we really love that are super helpful to so many people. Our first is Magnify Money. Check them out at stackingbenjamins.com/magnifymoney. And if you're somebody like a lot of us that didn't get an education about money in school, well, guess what? Magnify Money will not only help you compare your checking, your savings, and your credit cards, they also have a graduate guide. What's a graduate guide? Well, Nick Clements, CEO of Magnify Money, told us what it's all about.
Right. Well, we went out and we pulled recent college graduates who are about 5 years out and said, what are your biggest regrets? And some of their biggest regrets were not handling their student loans right away when they got out of school, organizing them and finding out the best way to pay and manage that going forward. And another was just not learning enough about their personal finances. And so what we've done is, based upon the regrets of people who graduated 5 years ago, we put together a checklist so that as long as you follow that list, you at least will not have the regrets, the same regrets that these people have.
There it is. Head to stackingbenjamins.com/magnify money for you or the graduate in your life to get an education about getting their financial house in order. And if you've listened to the show before, you know I'm also excited about our second sponsor, SoFi. That's S-O-F-I. Head to stackingbenjamins.com/SoFi to check them out. And I've said in the past that you're not going to beat the interest rate on a student loan or on personal loans or mortgages outside of SoFi. However, I've also said you need a high credit score. What is a high credit score? And how does SoFi look at your credit? We asked Dan Macklin over at SoFi how it works.
So there's no absolute minimum that we have, but generally if you're in the 700s and above, then you have a great chance of being approved. But credit score is not the only thing we're looking for. There's a variety of measures, but it's one of them.
So even though it's not the only thing they look at, it's an important qualifier. So clean up your credit and then head to stackingbenjamins.com/SoFi when you're ready to get your mortgage, refinance your debt through a personal loan, or look at those student loans to get the interest rate down to something more manageable.
Hey everyone, it's Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and even though I just had to give away the keys to my Vespa because of the Carolina Panthers kicker, I'm still going to be the true professional on this show and deliver the answer you have all been waiting for. Before the break, I asked you this: which NFL team has the least expensive tickets? The answer? The Buffalo Bills home stadium, called New Era Field, charges only $36.33 for their cheapest ticket. Easily the lowest price in the NFL. Now, if they had a pro team that actually played on New Era Field in Buffalo, the prices would be way higher. But luckily for the Buffalo Bills fans, there isn't actually a pro team playing there. Oh man, this is going to be great. Joe's going to get his ass handed to him by all of our listeners in Buffalo. Still, that's a little out of my price range, so I'm off to mow Joe's mom's yard so I can beg $10 for sizzler money. See ya!
Big thanks to Donna Friedman for coming down to the basement. It's so fun.
Not quite as beautiful down here as it is looking at her backyard, I'm sure.
No, but she has struggled, hasn't she? Mm-hmm. I mean, well, what great tips. That woman knows a bunch. We'll have a link to her book, Your Playbook for Tough Times, on our show notes at stackingbenjamins.com. All right, let's fire up the hotline. As you know, we are between sponsors on the hotline, so we're calling this for this little period here. The OG is taking clients hotline.
I like the sound of that. I mean, it really really sounds like maybe that should be the sponsor moving forward.
StackyBenjamins.com/OG. If you want to know more about that, go to the Green Room episode where we talked extensively last week about OG deciding to finally help people beyond the show, which is, it's pretty cool. What a great story. But right now we've got a question on deck. Say hello, Mr. Anonymous.
Hey, Joe and OG, longtime listener, first time question. I was wondering, when is whole life insurance actually a good decision? I've heard you guys rant and rave and other people rant and rave about different things, but I know that there's a reason for each product on the market. And I was just wondering, when is whole life a good decision? Thanks.
I think Anonymous is just trying to stir the pot. That's the first thing I thought when he started talking.
Chum in the water. Trying to decide.
Here it comes.
How do we answer
this? Let's put the pressure on them. Well, first of all, our rant and rave has always been different than a lot of the rant and rave that we've heard elsewhere.
Yeah, our philosophy has always been there is a right time and a right place for every single, virtually every single investment product.
Just like Mr. Anonymous just said, he's right on. There is a right time and place. So what is that right time and place?
Well, I'm going to back it up just a little bit. And I'm going to say, let's take out the word whole life. And let's just talk about permanent insurance versus term insurance. This is kind of the big debate. People lump this together and say whole life is permanent insurance, but there's multiple types of permanent insurance, right? So you've got whole life, universal life, variable universal life, index universal life now, all different types of permanent policies. But let's just talk just quick globally about the big ones. So term policies insure you for a set amount for a set period of time. And then if you don't die during that time, you are done. The policy ends. Some companies allow you the opportunity to continue the policy. Some policies allow you to have a return of premium. You can buy all these like extra features, but kind of your bare bones minimum term policy is I want $1 million for 30 years. I'm going to pay $60 a month. I'm going to do that for 30 years. If I'm not dead, done.
Bam.
Okay. Permanent life is a whole different thing. Permanent life is good for your whole life. Right? Your permanent life, as long as you're around, it's permanent insurance, as long as you pay the premiums. And permanent life works a little bit differently in that you pay a premium, but not all of that is used for the cost. See, the difference is that in term insurance, all of it's used for the cost of the insurance, right? So some of that is retained by the policy and in one way, shape, or form is invested.
This is a key feature, by the way, that I want to pause you for just a second on because people don't understand this. That when people compare a premium payment per month on a term policy and a premium payment per month on a permanent policy, you're looking at an apple and an orange.
Right.
Because what OG just said was only a portion of that premium in the permanent policy actually is paying for that month. The rest of it, you think about the rest of it goes into a pot so that when you stop paying, there still is a cost, but now it's not coming out of your pocket. It's coming out of money that you prepaid.
Exactly. I mean, basically, when you've got a whole life, permanent life, universal life, whatever, you're effectively kind of prepaying insurance now and getting an interest rate on that, whether it's fixed or variable. You're getting some interest rate on that for a period of time so that when you're X years old, 65 years old, and you retire, you can say, I'm going to be done paying the policy. But now I've got enough cash there that it can pay itself for the next 35 years or until I die, and it's going to stay in force, right? It's going to stay around until I go. So those are the two different types, and we can spend a whole bunch of time talking about the individual types in there.
But yeah, can we talk about one more thing?
Yeah, please.
Permanent insurance still. So even if you get rid of the part that's going into this bucket to pay the future premiums, uh-huh. You know, they call it the cash value,
right.
Of the policy, permanent insurance – one unit, let's say a unit's $1,000, one unit of insurance is still going to be more expensive than one unit a term. And the reason is that there's 100% chance if you fund it correctly that this is going to be enforced when you die. And so it's going to cost the insurance company a lot more money. And insurance yeah. companies are not in the business of losing money,
they
right?
Don't. Those big buildings were not built on, it's like the casino. I'm going to go to the casino and win. Like, okay.
Right.
Well, that marble flooring sure was paid by somebody.
That MetLife blimp over the football game.
Right.
Probably funded in part by you if yes. you have a permanent policy. So it's still going to be more expensive. Doesn't
yeah, there is that myth that all insurance costs the same if you peel it away. But I'm with you. If you look at the cost of insurance for permanent and the cost of insurance for term,
terms are going to be cheaper.
Yeah. Okay. So we've talked about term. We talked about permanent. Why is there ever a scenario in which permanent insurance makes sense?
I can think of two.
So the first one that comes to mind is for long-term estate planning.
Amen, brother.
You are a family and you have $11 million, or it's projected that your household is going to have $11 million when you pass away. You look at the current estate tax limits and you say, boy, oh boy, if me and Mrs. OG die and we leave the kids $12 million, we're going to pay $1 million in federal taxes. Is there a way to change that? A lot of times permanent insurance is used for that purpose. The only other one that I can kind of think of would be if you converted a term policy to a permanent policy because you were uninsurable.
Actually, it's funny. I didn't think of that one.
So let me do that one real fast and then you can add yours. So let's say that you have a term policy and you bought it when you were 28 and you had a 30-year policy. Now you're 58 and the policy is about to expire, right? And now you have some sort of medical issue that prevents you from buying another 20-year policy. Or however long you wanted to have it for, but you still have an insurable need, like you still have a need for insurance, but now you can't get it. Some companies will allow you to take that term policy and convert it to a permanent policy without any other underwriting or any other sort of anything. You would want to take advantage of that because knowing that you can't qualify any other way. And then you have it because of that reason. So what's your, I guess, maybe third reason then, you are in agreement that.
I like that one. I actually have two others. I thought of another one while you were talking.
Ah, darn. So, guess we're selling permanent insurance all day, baby. Make it rain.
Which is so, these are such niche areas, right? But the next one is I had clients, my job as a financial advisor when I was in that business, when I was in your business, was to tell people what their options were, right? We would figure out how much insurance somebody needed. And we would do two methods. We would look at the lowest common denominator, like if everything goes right, how much insurance do you need? Called a capital needs analysis. Then the second thing that we would do is we'd do what's called the human life value. And that would give us, boy, we're full of football analogies today, but it would give us the goalposts. And then we'd talk about how conservative are you versus how aggressive are you. And most people, by the way, were fairly aggressive with their life insurance. I want as little as possible. Right.
Yeah. Insurance is next to taxes as the least favorite thing to spend money on.
But, and these people too, I would have maybe one client every other year, super duper duper conservative, and just said, I want to make sure it's there. I want to make sure it's there when I die. And I would even say, I'm thinking of one particular client, by the way, I said, you're not going to need it. And she said, but I like the fact that I'm going to have it. And I said, it's going to cost you a lot of money. And I think I even did the math. This is how much it's going to cost. She's like, but that's over my lifetime. That's like looking at my 30-year mortgage and all that interest I'm going to pay, right? She said, it's going to cost it over my lifetime. I will feel so much better. And we have the money. This for me is a great thing to spend it on because I know no matter what happens with the financial markets, no matter what happens with other things, that I have this in the bank, conservative out there. Wow.
The 1 in 5 year.
But that's what insurance is. That's exactly what insurance is. And she made the right decision for her. Not the right decision for me, but it was the right decision for her. And I felt very good about her purchasing that policy when she did. Yeah. The bigger one was an issue that we talked about on the show recently. And we didn't get into this because it was too technical, but we talked.
But since we're here.
We are here, Mr. Anonymous, bringing us here, evil man you.
Maybe he wants to buy some life insurance, Joe.
Maybe he does.
Keep him on the good side. Be nice to him.
If you want to buy some life insurance from us, I wish I had my license. Yeah. But the next one was we've talked recently about these people that they look at all their goals and they're not going to spend all of their money. And then what do? Then we double their expenses. And when we double their expenses, they still have money left over. And then we say, okay, let's take a quarter of that money that you have left over after you've doubled expenses and you have all this leftover money. Let's take a quarter of that and let's get it efficiently to your children. What is that? You take that amount of money. Maybe it's $50,000. Maybe it's $200,000. I mean, I don't know how much money people have over and above their goal, but whatever that is, we take that amount of money and we see just how much life insurance we can buy. Because then we ensure that we know that X amount's going to the kids. It's going to go tax-free or to the charity or whatever. Going to go to right. beneficiaries. It's going to go tax-free. It's going to get there. It's going to get there quick. I don't got to worry about selling stuff. It's just, it's the most efficient way.
There's some pretty nice liquidity when it comes to life insurance. And it's the only thing that has a guaranteed payoff, right? So we know the outcome. And to your point, is a very effective compounding. I forgot this discussion that we had a couple of weeks ago because I would have brought this up, but it's an effective way for compounding to charity. It is. I mean, I like it for that, but really those are the few and far between options.
Those are all niche.
Yeah.
So if you have an insurance agent telling you that it's the best way to put your kids through college,
yeah,
probably not.
Yeah. And so if you run into that, I'm happy to run the analysis both ways for you and show you the scenario. The other thing that's kind of interesting is that when it comes to insurance agents, square peg and round hole, right? It's if all I've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. In our business, we don't have any limitations on the products that we have available to us. So a lot of times, even if you're working with an insurance agent that's repping a specific company, say, I don't know.
Say some company.
Yeah, insert company here. I don't want to throw anybody under the bus. But you know what I mean?
Yeah,
all their stuff is going to be the best.
That's all they got.
To shop around to look at that. So, but yeah, if you've met with a financial advisor, and I'm using air quotes on that, and you're 26 years old and you're married, just married, and you don't have any kids, and they just said, "Hey, the best thing for you to put your money in is this whole life policy
instead of a 529."
Instead of a five, yeah, yeah. Well, even if you don't have kids, this will be great for your retirement. Bank on yourself, person. Yeah, no.
Yeah, good stuff. Thanks for the question, Anonymous. Thanks for nothing, for getting us into the weeds on that one.
We're both finance nerds, so we can talk about this stuff.
I know, but I groan because I'm like, oh, man. I do like that topic, but it's a tough one.
I like the and the reality is that I love the complicated financial planning cases because those are the times when you get to use those esoteric uses of products that are for the right purpose. And I know that you always got excited about that too when you did a financial planning case. You go, I finally found the right reason to use this thing.
Yeah.
You know, yay, go team Saucy High, you know.
But then the hard thing was with educated people, convincing them that they were the right case because they've heard so much of this is always the wrong case.
Yeah.
You know, and I have to say, yes, it is. It is the wrong case 99% of the time. Guess what? You're the 1%.
You're the 1%.
Yes.
How's the air up there, Mr. 1%?
Hello, Mr. 1%. By the way, you used the phrase going both ways, second time in two shows. What's up with that?
I did. I didn't hear myself.
You said you could go both ways. And I'm like, wow, you're in love with that term.
Sorry. I'll do my best to not use that ever again.
Well, no. I wonder what's going on. It's like you got
to. Stop. Carry on.
Doug brought down the mail. Our next letter from the mailbag comes to us from Michelle. Michelle says, "Hey, Joe and OG, I'm a newish fan of the show. Started listening a little over 6 months ago when I finally started paying attention to this retirement thing. Where have you been, Michelle?"
Hello, Michelle.
"We've been waiting for you, so we're so glad you're here. Finally, you're the first podcast I listen to every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday morning. Thanks for all you do." Thanks. Michelle asked this, "I recently changed jobs and I rolled over all my 401k into a Vanguard Roth and traditional IRA. My old 401k was at Vanguard. I have about $25,000 in both accounts combined. The two main tools I use to keep my financial life organized are personal capital for cash flow and net worth monitoring, goal setting, and future advisor for my portfolio allocation, which I like because it's a robo, but I keep control."
Yeah, it's really hard, by the way, on like 401ks and that sort of thing to have a robo advisor do that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it's.
Yeah. I mean, we had Bloom on recently, but then they do it.
Yeah.
Like they really do it. She says, "I'm definitely not interested in a betterment type option after your discussion post Brexit, not an advisor until she's over the 100,000 mark, which is her 3-year goal." Okay. "Personal capital also has an investment allocation section, although it isn't automated. And she's noticed personal capital and future advisor allocations are different, even though she's entered the investment preferences the exact same. Very aggressive, retirement age of 60. Currently, she's 27. Future advisor says she's balanced with about 44% international and 30% in U.S., 16% REITs, 10% bonds. Meanwhile, personal capital says her portfolio needs adjusting because she should only have about 26% international, 60% U.S., 10% REITs, and 4% bonds. So just lining these up, Personal Capital says 26% international. Future Advisor says 44. Future Advisor says 30% U.S., 60% U.S. for Personal Capital. Why are the allocations between U.S. and international so different between the two? This question is preventing me from continuing to invest, but it's driving me a little crazy not knowing the reason and frustrated because every time she tries to research it, all she finds is someone's blog post or article giving their own different allocation recommendation. She doesn't know if there's a correct answer, but which one sounds like the better option. Thanks a ton for the question, Michelle.
All right. So I have a couple of pieces of info here. So when it comes to financial planning, the way that we look at it is this. You say, here's my goal. Then we ask you to complete a risk tolerance questionnaire. We use a company called Riskalyze. And I was just thinking, I don't think that we've had Riskalyze on, have we?
Mm-mm.
We should contact Aaron Klein as the CEO, and we could get him on a Friday show.
Talk about
show.
That fintech. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's through advisors, so I'm not entirely sure that it's available for consumers, you know, direct to consumer.
We can find out.
Yeah, but we can find out. But that's what we use, and it's statistically significant, which means that when we use that tool, it's going to give us the range of returns that's accurate 95% of the time. So you're never going to say, I guarantee we're going to go, you know, this is what's going to happen. So we start with the risk tolerance piece. What sort of volatility can you tolerate? So the idea is if you want the all stock returns, you got to be okay with the all stock losses too, right? So if you want all the plus 10s, you got to be okay with the minus 40s. You know, if you want the plus 40s, you got to get the minus 40s if you want the average of 10. So once we know what your volatility tolerance is, then we can say what sort of investments, what sort of tools have historically provided the correct balance of risk and return to produce that range of returns that you're looking for. And we just use history since 1926. So that's when we start using our data from. So almost 90 years now. When you add more international, historically, you're adding more volatility. Would you agree with that, Joe?
Yes.
Yes. So right now, just about half of the world's gross domestic product is produced in the United States, and half of it is produced outside of the United States. So arguably, you could look at that and say, well, shouldn't I have half my money in U.S. and half my money outside of the U.S.?
Sure. Okay.
If you believe that each unit of risk results in one unit of return, and that number is the same. So if you think, if you look at the U.S. stock market and say, if I take one more unit of risk, I get one more unit of return. And that is also true in international exposure. But that's not true. International might be 2-to-1. I get one unit of return for every 2 units of risk. But that range of returns is more volatile. So I can't answer it specifically as to which one is best. But I can say subjectively that the more international that you have, the more volatility you're going to be exposed to overall.
Well, I was going to say that I think it's funny. I think just looking at those, I think both allocations are right. It seems to be that Future Advisor seems to be buying Michelle some additional volatility with that international real estate, but then countering it on the other side with more bond exposure. You see what I mean?
I thought they were both 10, were they not?
No, the bond exposure, you've got 16% REIT and 10% bonds on Future Advisor, and you've got 10% REIT and 4% bonds on Personal Capital.
Okay.
So you've got a much bigger REIT and bond exposure on.
So I would, and I happen to agree with that from a philosophical standpoint. And again, you got to look at the fixed income piece of it too. I really think that the more fixed income that you have actually leads to more volatility at this point because of.
But what's cool about that volatility from where I sit is that that volatility, it's different volatility, which is why I kind of like Future Advisors better than Personal Capital when I look at these two, not because it's quote better, because I think they're both going to kind of head the same direction because one is taking more volatility over here. Bonds are giving a little different type of volatility versus a lot of U.S. stock. I think I like Future Advisor because it splits the pie. It's not taking such a big bet in one single asset class as much.
Yeah. I come from the position of this is just purely math and science, right? So there is not a right answer for everyone, but there's a right answer for Michelle, if that makes sense. So I'm going to look at all the pieces and say, how do they all work together? to get to the volatility, to get the number historically that we're looking for to build the financial plan. You know, that's kind of how I'm going to come at it. And arguably, supposedly, that's what they're doing here too.
Well, they are. They're using modern portfolio theory, but I think that they're, you know, you can put constraints on your portfolios. Yeah. And I think that their constraints are different. In other words, they can say, okay, don't take REITs above 10%, let's say,
yeah.
or don't take bonds above 5%. Well, you know, they'll put those constraints and then the math will find itself based on the constraints right. that they put in there.
Yeah, they've kind of got their own in there.
Yeah, both right.
So, Michelle, I guess ultimately what Joe's saying is that both of them could get you where you're going. I would say that there's a right one for you.
And by the way, back on Betterment too, we weren't bashing Betterment as much as we were bashing Betterment's marketing. Why are companies like, and not Betterment itself, by the way, but why is Betterment marketing so hard to people that are just starting to save? Like, you don't need 18 different funds when you have $2,000. You need one fund.
I think she was talking about when they stopped trading.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah, the Brexit.
Yeah, the Brexit trading.
Yeah, that was a mess.
You're like, okay, yeah, now we can bash it.
Yes, yeah, we will bash that. That was not good.
There's some fallout there.
All right, good stuff. Thanks to Anonymous for the hotline call. Head to stackybenjamins.com/voicemail to do that. And you're right, OG, to Michelle for the letter. If you want to send us a letter, send that to me, joe@stackybenjamins.com. Thanks also to everybody who's left us a review of the show. Those help people find this here little podcast. It's been so exciting, OG, as we've hung out in the top 20 lately. That's been incredibly exciting. Next review is from Addicted Number One Fan. 5 stars, says, great light financial podcast. Stacking Benjamins is my go-to podcast on my long commute to and from work. Very light financial podcast where the hosts pride themselves in, quote, not teaching anything. Little joke the hosts love to repeat. I find we don't repeat that joke anymore as much as our listeners repeat it.
It's been kind of a mainstay now.
Yeah. Despite that, I found the podcast extremely informative. They invite top-tier guests, which are often very successful authors, entrepreneurs, or fellow podcasters. My favorite's The Roundtable, where they discuss various topics with Len, Paula, and Greg. Excellent podcast. Keep up the good work, Joe and OG. Thank you, Number One Fan. We appreciate the kind words. And if you can take just a second and leave us just a little short review, that'll help people understand what we're doing here on the show. That's going to do it, man, for this particular episode. Man, start of another fun week, OG.
Gotta love Mondays.
It is.
Mondays mean you're one more day closer to Saturday.
which is all we think about, starting Monday at 9 a.m. Right. All right, everybody. We'll see you on the Green Room episode tomorrow and then back here, Stacking More Benjamins on Wednesday. Bye-bye.
So friends, what did we learn on today's show? Well, it looks like I got to do the hard work and actually clarify this for you since Joe and OG can't seem to do it. First, own a target date fund? Check your fees, just so you know you're not paying too much. Also, want to be frugal? Follow Donna Friedman's advice and start with the basics. But the big lesson here, if you've got the Panthers kicker at the end of the game to win $50 and keep your scooter, kiss your f***ing money goodbye. This show is the property of SB Podcast, LLC. The show is created by Josal Sehi, produced by Richie Rutter Reese, and engineered by the amazing Steve Stewart. Special thanks to Donna Friedman for joining us in the basement today. You'll find her book at donnafriedman.com or at stackingbenjamins.com/Amazon or on our show notes at stackingbenjamins.com. Pretty much you can find this book wherever you look. Be careful walking out your front door. You're probably going to trip over it. Looking for some cool swag? The new t-shirts are in! The new t-shirts are in! Some of you are going to get that reference. Grab one at stackingbenjamins.com/shirts. Special thanks to Joe's mom for letting me borrow Joe's dad's 10-speed to head on down to the Sizzler tonight. If I rake the leaves this entire fall, she said she might even think about letting me borrow the car sometime. That lady, Mother Teresa's a street hustler compared to her. She's a princess.
Been playing some board games.
You think?
We haven't talked board games a little while on the show. There's some cool stuff. I just, on Kickstarter, I think this game is now out. It's called Stockpile.
Okay. I see it there.
Yeah. And it's the game of insider trading.
Nice.
So what's cool about this game is it plays really quickly. And I bought it because it was funny when I was reading, there's a big website, you and I know about this, but people new to the show don't know about this. There's a big website for people that like board games called Board Game Geek. And it's funny. It's a hilarious name, and they know it's hilarious, but they have, you've been on Board Game Geek before. They have bajillions of board games, and a few million people go there a day. It's an incredible place.
Is that all?
Yes. Almost as many as come to Stack and Benches.
They're getting there. They're growing.
Wouldn't that be a great day? So when I was reading, as they were getting ready to put this on Kickstarter, because some people owned it, and then it went out of print, and then they were making expansion and kickstarting it. And I was reading about it, and it said, it's a good family game, but it's kind of light, a little bit random. And I thought, my family likes lightish games. They like a little bit random games. And that was a little overblown. I thought, for families, this game's a blast, OG. So what happens is you have these six different stocks, and everyone around the table gets a share of stock that only you know about. You get a piece of information, like let's say it's in the newspaper. You get a piece of information, and then you get a second card, and they're shuffled. There's one thing that says up or down for that stock. So it might say it moves up $2 or moves down a dollar, might move down $4. Maybe it's going to pay a dividend, but it's something's going to happen to that stock. So there's six of those, and there's six stocks. You shuffle the deck separately, and you give everybody a stock, and then you give them whether it's going to go up or down. So you know ahead of time what's going to happen to one of the six stocks.
Okay.
And then you get a couple cards in your hand, which are shares of stock, and you put them in these piles. And you put one in a pile face up and one in a pile face down. And sometimes there's trading fees instead, and other times there's move a stock up or down. And so I might put this trading fee upside down on a stock I know everybody else is going to want, but I don't want it because I know it's going to go down, because I already have the insider information that nobody else has about that particular stock. And then I put another stock that looks like crap, but I'm pretty sure that if mine's going down, there's only so many down cards and so many up cards. So there's a better chance of it going up than down. I'm going to put it on the face up. So I put one face down on one pile, one face up either on the same pile or on a different pile. And then you have these little markers and you start outbidding each other for the piles. And that's how you accumulate stocks. And if your stock goes all the way to $10, it then splits. And now you have double the shares of that stock. And it's exciting when the share splits. And of course, if the stock goes to zero, you got to take all your shares and throw them away. You know, you throw them in the discard pile because they are gone.
They're useless. It's
the first time we played it, the companies all have alliteration. And the A is American Automotive.
Okay.
American Automotive couldn't stop going bankrupt the first time we played this game. I think it went bankrupt like three times. We played this game so many times now, and we've never had it happen since. But that first time, it was hilarious because the auto manufacturers in America could not stay solvent. I'm like, wow, that's how I proposed that. So I want to tell you about that one. I think you're...
My kids are too young for that.
Yeah. I think your oldest actually isn't. Then another one that we just got. This is a pretty cool one. Look at that artwork.
Okay.
World's Fair, 1893. So they have all of these, you know, that's when the Ferris wheel debuted. It was in Chicago. Did you read Devil in the White City?
No.
I've heard it's a fantastic book. But this is that World's Fair in Chicago. And you are building the World's Fair. And so you've got people that were big in the World's Fair and different things that came out. Interesting game, 45 minutes long, like a short game.
It's pretty quick. Yeah.
Yeah. Haven't played it yet, so I can't talk about it because I just got it. Just got it actually right after I went to your house. So can't wait to play that.
Where are you going to store all this stuff? You're running out of space, dude.
No, I sell the ones that we don't play.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. Every year we sell a bunch of board games.
Huh.
Some games just don't get played. And then a third game that we've played a few times is called Time Stories. Have I shown you Time Stories?
I don't think so.
So Time Stories is a game where you're all on the same team. And at the beginning of the game, they tell you that you're going someplace in time. So the first game, we were going back to the 1920s, and we were going to an insane asylum in France. And not only were we going to this asylum, but you inhabit people that were in the asylum. So you pick one of the people, like one of our guys, this big bruiser guy. And as long as he keeps hitting people in fights, he is happy. But if he misses too many times, he gets frustrated and he starts beating up the people on his own team. So you just got to keep that dude happy. And there's a woman who has to be with somebody else. And then there's this old, bat who is just mean as all get out, but she can die very quickly. You have this map of the asylum and you go in a room and there's this beautiful artwork, just gorgeous art of like four panels of art. And you take your pieces for the different people and you say, well, I'm going to go to this part of the room. I'm going to go to this part. I'm going to go to this part. I'm going to go to this part. And then everybody takes their piece and you turn it over and you read what's going on in that section of the room. You turn it back over and put it down. And once it's all down, everybody describes what they saw. And then they decide together what they're going to do. So you're trying to solve a mystery together. And then this first one, some people in the asylum have disappeared and you have to figure out what happened to them while the nurses think that you're inmates at the asylum. So it's kind of a, you know, there's this little, I don't know, role-playing aspect, which makes me a little uncomfortable, but generally just the whole storytelling piece and that you're all on the same team is neat. And then, but they have different ones. The second one's called the Marcy case and you go back to the early 1990s. And then I just got this third one, which is, you go to, it says 7553, A Prophecy of Dragons. So this is a new one. And they just came out with an Egyptian one. So these, things you do with time stories. So those are board games I've been playing. You've been planning to get, you played Ticket to Ride recently, but I think we might've talked about that on the show.
Yeah, we talked about that. No, I haven't played any games.
We got to do it. Got to do it.
It's good family time. I do agree with that.
It is.
No, I played Chutes and Ladders and I lost. Legitimately lost.
Is it bad that I think that game's kind of fun? I mean, it is totally random, but when you get that big slide or the big ladder, I don't know what it is about that that is exciting.
I got a lot of the slides. A lot of chutes. Not a lot of ladders.
Bad case of the chutes?
Yep.
All right, man. We'll see you later.